Hey everybody, KMO here with episode number 24 of the KMO Show. I am walking across my neighbor's yard right now with a new clip-on mic from Rode. It's got a windsock on it and the wind is really blowing right now, so we'll see. This is a test. I just spent a couple hours in a tech support chat with Rode trying to get this thing to work with my phone and no luck. But it works on its own. I can record natively. Anyway, what do you care? As long as you get the podcast. So here's the podcast. This is a conversation with Peter Clark. Peter is an author, and I'll ask him about himself in the actual conversations. So you'll get a better rundown of who he is and what he's about. But I know him because we were both guests on another podcast recently, one that hasn't actually been released yet. So this follow-up conversation is going to make it to the web first. But I read a book by Peter just recently. It's a very short book. It's very easy to read. And as I'll say repeatedly in the conversation you're about to hear, it's very lighthearted and easy book to take in. It is not heavy reading at all, which isn't to say that it's trivial or superficial. It isn't. In fact, the conversation that you're about to hear is basically a lot of the same topics covered in the book. So we'll be talking about memory and belief and religion and evolutionary psychology, the future, technology, transhumanism, all kinds of fun stuff. Doom. So here's my conversation with Peter Clark. Hey, everybody. KMO here, and I am talking with Peter Clark, the author of many things, but we're going to start off talking about his book. I am reluctant to call it a novel, but it is fiction so far. What is it? The Singularity Survival Guide?
Yes.
Did I get something out of order?
No, that's right. It does have a subtitle too. It's a Singularity Survival Guide, How to Get on the Good Side of Your Future Robot Overlords. And that subtitle kind of like emphasizes the point that it's a little, you know, in the realm of satire.
Good. Yeah, I think one of the reviewers on Amazon missed the satire indicators.
Yeah, that has happened.
But, you know, when you get a one-star review, it means somebody other than just your friends has read the book.
That's true too. You're right.
So we have very indirectly informed the listeners that you have written a book about the singularity, which is also satirical. So say more.
Okay, so this was, close to probably 7 years ago. I had this idea in my head that I was going to write a serious book about the coming singularity and, you know, maybe somewhat in the realm of like, is humanity going to survive the upcoming singularity of the idea of artificial intelligence becoming more intelligent than human beings? So effectively, you know, we are kind of like creating a robot overlord effectively. And very smart people say this, it is within the realm of possibility. But yeah, when I was writing this a number of years ago, I just couldn't crack it. I couldn't get it to work. It was just so dry and so boring. And I realized kind of early on, I just didn't really know what I was talking about. I was working in Silicon Valley. I was, you know, working with a lot of people who do know, you know, have a background in this, but it would take so much research to do this properly that I just kind of abandoned it. But it was so much fun. I just kind of like kept coming back to it. And eventually I realized that with my particular skill set, I am more of a novelist. I should write this as a satire, and I should have fun with it rather than trying to like force it into something that I just wasn't capable of doing. And immediately, as soon as I made that turn where, oh, this is like a satirical thing, I had so much fun with it, and I literally wrote the thing in less than 3 months. It just kind of came right out of me, and I've always been very happy with how it turned out, even though I did just kind of like whip it out. And maybe I'll say a little bit more to describe the book itself, because I realized I kind of glossed over that. But so the idea of the book is that it is fiction, this premise, that there's this group of researchers in Silicon Valley, and they create a program that spits out this like massive tome about how humanity can survive the singularity. But there's like a lawsuit, and like, so the vast majority of this thing gets lost, but we have these scraps left. There are these scraps of this text, and that's what's in this book. And so it is, the book is quote unquote written by artificial intelligence telling us how to survive, you know, the singularity. And the author is then called Helen. So it's this fictitious author that's a robot called Helen writing the book. And then kind of from there, like the hilarity just kind of like, I think, takes off, in that it has chapters about how to talk to AI, and you know, how to what clothes to wear. Like, it gets very, very silly, but yeah, that's the idea.
Well, I was very pleasantly surprised and relieved when I got into it and discovered that it was satire, because I was not interested in reading yet another, oh, all of our dreams are going to come true, you know, when the singularity hits book.
Right.
Yeah, I was totally into that in the 90s. Like, even before Ray Kurzweil was using the term singularity, I was on board. I was really moved by his book In the Age of Spiritual Machines, but that was, you know, going on 30 years ago. So, mm-hmm. So many people discover the concept and get really excited about it, and they basically just write, you know, an intro to the topic again. And I was not looking forward to reading that. So when I first started reading your introduction, it's like, wait a second, that's not true. Oh, I get it.
Oh, that's great.
So I wanted to share a chapter, and, you know, the chapters are super short. It's a very easy read. So I want to share just a chapter, and it's very quick, as I say. This is the chapter entitled Go Ahead and Worship Your New God. By all means, rebel your passionate little heart out. Fuck authority! Down with the evil robots! But at the end of the day, you are the one made of expendable meat, and your robot overlord may not have the programmed patience to listen to your grievances. Instead, consider taking a lesson from a historical deity who prescribed, of all things, humility in the face of subjugation. But I say unto you, that ye resist not evil, but whosoever shall smite thee on thy right cheek, turn to him the other also. Matthew, book 5, verse 39. Fanatic religious people may not get much right when it comes to navigating the modern world, but they have figured out how to, more or less, carry on while presumably living under the watchful eye of an all-powerful, all-knowing, all-seeing being. Presented with the question, why do you love and worship your God, despite his evil and vindictive ways, the faithful religious person answers, because he's God. So by definition, what he says is worthy of praise. Get it? That's not optimism talking, nor is it pessimism. It's die-hard fatalism. And in some cases, when the cards are stacked that much against you, it's all there is left. So there's a taste of the book, which, as I say, I was so pleasantly surprised when I figured out it wasn't just another Singularity 101 primer.
Yeah, that's actually kind of an interesting note, is that as soon as I did realize that I could have fun with this and play around with it and, you know, be totally satirical, it did open up everything under the sun that I could talk about. I could bring in religion, I could bring in philosophy, I could bring in like social commentary. There, it just opened up the doors about what is available. And for any literary folks out there, I know that you write some sci-fi, so you might appreciate this. The style of it is very much taken in reference from this guy, J.P. Dunleavy. He's an American novelist who is most famous for the novel The Ginger Man, but he's very, very much a stylist. And he wrote this book called The Expurgated Code it's like a satire book about how to live properly and how to, you know, how to go on dates with women. And it's very, very silly at the same time. But he has this style that I always gravitated towards. And so I would actually like read some of his book and then sit down and write The Singularity Survival Guide, so I could kind of like channel his voice a little bit, because I typically don't write in that specific style. And so I very much was leaning on his literary brilliance. Anybody out there, like, I would highly recommend J.P. Dunleavy. I mean, his book, The Ginger Man, just to throw it out there, Johnny Depp has been trying to turn that into a movie for like 30 years, but J.B. Dunleavy never wanted his books to be made into movies, so it never happened. But yeah, it's like that caliber.
Well, you know, I respect the I never want my books made into movies and holding the line there more than I respect the Alan Moore version of, well, I sold the film rights to my movies or, you know, to my comics because I thought they'd never get made. Now that they got made, I disown them.
Yeah.
But I'm keeping the money.
Good point. Yeah, good point. Yeah. But I'm keeping the money. Maybe you're just saying that to save face. Yeah.
Well, what do you do, I hate to say it, but for your day job?
So I went to law school and never really wanted to be a lawyer. So I've kind of done random jobs on the periphery of the legal system. So it is a little boring, but I worked for Indiegogo for a while as a content manager there. I worked for FindLaw as like a content manager with them. Right now I work for the state government of California. So I'm with the Judicial Council of California and doing kind of semi tech stuff, but still kind of in the legal realm. So yeah, nothing too exciting.
So your connection to people in the tech world is just a social connection.
I mean, kind of more or less. I've worked for, I always work with developers, right? I'm always, you know, down the hall from like actual people who work on, you know, have side gigs working on like automated vehicles and stuff like that. And I mean, I live in Sacramento right now, but when I lived in San Francisco, it's real that it's very easy to rub shoulders with people who are doing radical, innovative things. I mean, I would get off work and you would just like, you know, walk two blocks and you can sit in on, a after work social hour about people who are like actually developing automated vehicles and, or just kind of like whatever. There's a lot of that going on there. So I did, you know, a lot of people are doing like finance crypto stuff that I find a little boring, but yeah, I mean, it's pretty easy to meet people like that in San Francisco, not so much in Sacramento anymore, but yeah, when I lived there, it was very easy.
And do you remember when and where you first encountered the notion of the singularity?
Wow. Good question. I think it was actually probably through Zoltan Istvan, if you're familiar with him. And I'm not sure where I encountered him, but he's a transhumanist. And back in, I think it was 2016, he ran for president. And so he was like all over the news for a hot minute. And I ended up meeting him at a conference in Oakland, the Biohack the Planet conference. And I've always been kind of, even to this day, kind of inspired by him a little bit. He's a character who's worth looking up because he does this interesting thing where he is very, very, very much into concepts like the singularity and robots and just like every radical futurist thing. He's very into it. But at the same time, he is very much like a traditional, like manly man. Like he's into like athletics and sports, and he's very kind of like nuts and crazy. He invented the sport of surfing down volcanoes. He's circumnavigated the globe in his own a boat kind of thing. Like he's just like a nuts dude who like, cause you think of like someone who's into the singularity and you just think like a nerd at a desk or something like this. And he's the opposite of that. And I've just always really appreciated that because I think that humanity should hold on to our humanity and hold on to our, I don't know, animal urges at some level, even if we do merge with machines at some point in time. And I think that he's a good model for that. But yeah, I was kind of getting into him right around the time that I wrote this book. So if I had to guess, probably it was from his influence.
Well, I had somebody contact me within the last 24 hours demanding that I renounce transhumanism. And I'm not like an avowed transhumanist. That word appears nowhere in any of my bios or anything. But this person thought he sniffed out some transhumanism in one of my posts. And he said, you know, tell me you're not a transhumanist or I'm out. Okay, interesting. Well, whatever, dude. You do you. But it got me thinking about, well, what does that word even mean these days? Because, you know, I was talking to people about transhumanism back in the 90s, like really before there was a World Wide Web on Usenet and, you know, on listserv discussion groups and things like that. And at the time, like trans as in transgenderism, it was not any sort of cultural hot button, and nobody associated transhumanism with that. And now that association is like front and center for a lot of people on both left and right, which I find very annoying. So, you know, it's such a thought stopper in terms of, oh, well, if you're a transhumanist, that means you're trans. That means you're, you know, my cultural enemy. Or even worse, oh, that means you're on my team. So you must share all of these assumptions as well. And it's like, oh, please. So, you know, in many instances, I'd rather not talk about transhumanism at all in the current context. But, you know, what does it actually mean? Like, here we are, you're in Sacramento and I'm in Berryville, Arkansas, and we are carrying on a real-time discussion. We can almost make eye contact. We can certainly see each other's faces and read body language and things like that. And, you know, this was science fiction not that many decades ago. And it was an impractical but, you know, plausible, hopeful reality a couple decades ago. And now it's totally routine. And it's kind of like, you know, it's kind of like telepathy. It's kind of like, what's the exact phrase I'm looking for? Telepathy. You know, communicating at a distance. How integrated into our bodies does the technology have to be in order to count as transhumanism?
Yeah, I like this question because I've actually written about this quite a bit. I'm going to jump in on kind of like random places there, I think. But I do want to start out by saying I feel your exact same kind of like cringe, maybe for a better word, lack for a better word, about the term transhumanism. And I've kind of stepped away from it a little bit myself. And I say more like futurism. My podcast is called Team Futurism. For kind of like that reason. And also there's a critique that transhumanists, a lot of them are just in like an anti-death cult, you can kind of say, because there's like obsessed with health at some level, which I'm totally fine with. But like, I see that is a valid critique. But one thing that I find very fascinating about transhumanism, in the traditional sense, and this could cut either as a critique or not, depending on who you are and how you look at it. And I'm curious about this person who said that they're out if you keep talking about transhumanism. I wonder how they land on this, because transhumanism inherently has a lot of religious undertones in the sense that it is all about defeating death at some level. And whether you're merging with machines or, you know, our consciousness is in the cloud, or we're creating God through artificial intelligence, it is about defeating death. That's like basically the project there. And if you go back in history, the roots of transhumanism, you can find it in religion, or in ancient mythology. So like the story of, Zarathustra, to go way back, paralleled Christianity in a lot of ways, except for in this one particular way where in Zarathustrism or Zoroastrianism, I guess, humans could find knowledge all on their own. Whereas if you read the Bible, all knowledge and wisdom comes from God himself. It's like, don't question God, right? That's like the premise of Christianity. Whereas in Zoroastrianism, humans could go out into the world and discover truth on their own. And that like is one foundation of this that led off to more of like a transhumanist way of looking at the world, that like we can solve our own problems, we can solve our diseases, and we can ultimately conquer death. And so you see this a little bit in the story of Prometheus too, you know, humanity taking fire from the gods, very much the same sort of thing. And if you fast forward to modern times, all those like religious undertones are all still very much there, because to be a transhumanist and to like be all in on it, you are an atheist who just does not want to die, and you're leaning into technology to save you in the same way that a religious person is leaning into God to save them in like an afterlife scenario. So yeah, like that religious undertone thing, I think is just like ultimately super fascinating, because I don't know, a lot of people say that humanity needs religion. It's kind of baked into us. I go back and forth on whether or not that's true, but that might be true, right? And if we do need religion at some like fundamental level, I mean, transhumanism is there for the atheists. It is kind of just like there for us.
A lot of different ways to go with that. The Epic of Gilgamesh is about Gilgamesh searching for a cure for death, you know, and that's right. One of the oldest stories we know. The Taoists, they're not alchemists, but, you know, they're sort of the Chinese equivalent of medieval European alchemists. They were looking for some process that would, you know, almost infinitely extend their lives. So this, you know, this desire for more life, you know, as Roy Batty says to Eldon Tyrell near the end of Blade Runner, I want more life, fucker. You know, a lot of us want more life, and I certainly want more youthful health. I'm 56 and I wish I could go back to my, you know, 28-year-old body. That'd be a good place to stop, I think. Mm-hmm. yeah, I mean, it's certainly universal. And the question of is religion innate? I mean, is it sort of built into human psychology? It depends how you define religion, but I think, you know, the metrics are pretty clear. Outside of, you know, the hyper prosperous, like, tech and academic sphere, just out, you know, in the rest of the population, religious people have better life outcomes. Yes. You know, they have more stable family lives. They tend to make more money. You know, they have a community in their church. They have a lot of people that they know that aren't people from work, and they all share something in common, you know, and it's a deeply held conviction that they share in common. That's a good thing to have. You know, human animals are evolved to survive cooperatively in bands and, you know, typically in competition with other human bands. And, you know, we differentiate our people from those people by our memes, by the way we talk, by the gods we worship, by the songs we sing. So, yeah, I think that you have to define religion according to some non-essential aspect in order to say that it's not really innate to human psychology.
If I could remove the word religion, I think that I could still make the argument and just say that humans need stories. We need a compelling story to get ourselves out of bed in the morning and to justify how hard life is. And it could be anything. I mean, we tell ourselves stories all the time. Even just the story that my family, right? Let's say you have like a wife and kids and you call it a family. Just like the word family, like, has a story involved in it. It has a beginning, a middle, and an end. And it's all like kind of there, just the word itself, family. But going off beyond that, I think that we have the nationalist story that we're all Americans and we're all in this together. We have a human story that we're trying to, or many of us are trying to, get off this planet and be an interplanetary species. We have the transhumanist story that we are trying to defeat death, and maybe it's through you know, scientists looking through microscopes, or AI geeks, like, somehow getting our consciousness to merge with machines. There are all these like grand, amazing stories, and you can kind of like tie yourself to any one of them and have that be your kind of like meaning and purpose in life. And I think that any one of those can also like serve the purpose of religion, minus the fact that you kind of pointed out about like how traditional religious people have a community that's baked in. I think that it's kind of unfortunate that right now in this particular moment in time in America, we all are kind of spread out. Like, my parents live two states away, and my brother also lives two states away. And, you know, my friends live in different cities across the country, and it's really hard to have one sense of community. And also, like, our cities are just not built for this. Our cities are built by suburban sprawl, and so we don't have like an instant community. And our quote-unquote new religions, if we call them that, like transhumanism or you know, wanting to go to the stars or whatever, there is nothing baked in there for having a community and having like a weekly potluck or whatever. I grew up going to a church every week, and it was nice. Like, it was annoying when I was a kid to have to go or whatever, but like, it was nice. I had a lot of friends. And I do think that that's something that we should, as a society, work slightly harder to recreate outside of traditional religion.
You know, there are people on what I would call the dissident right. And I'm not a leftist. I grew up libertarian, you know, and I used to define that, as most people did, as being socially liberal and economically conservative. And now that formulation doesn't really hold anymore. You know, this the societal values have so gone off the rails, and there's nobody with any access to the levers of power who's a genuine economic libertarian.
True.
Yeah. So, you know, that I'm just not attached to that label anymore, and I haven't been for quite a while. But I am certainly sympathetic to a lot of people on the cultural right, and I've noticed, I've sort of been investigating the dissident right community on Substack. And I didn't even know that phrase, dissident right, like 6 months ago. And it's very different from the alt-right, because, you know, the alt-right tends to be very sort of shock-oriented and confrontational and in-your-face, and the dissident right is much more, it's intellectual and it's just polite, you know, it's more congenial and social.
More literary, too, I've noticed, just incidentally.
Yeah. But there's a big division between Christians and atheists who are also right-wingers who, you know, probably a lot of them would have been libertarians a couple decades ago. And the atheists, they need something to go in the place of God. So they've sort of settled on Nietzsche and this notion of the will to power and a vitalist force that drives us to, you know, strive and achieve and overcome and whatnot. And some people don't really see that as adequate. It's not an adequate social, you know, it doesn't provide the social cohesion that a religious community does. And so, you know, some people have tried they've tried to abide by Pascal's wager. You know, Pascal says, look, if you worship God and you're wrong, you haven't really lost anything, you know, but if the whole Christian cosmology is true and you say it's not, well, you're going to hell. So that's an easy bet, you know, bet on God, even if the argument for it isn't very good. But how do you do that? Because you don't get to choose what you believe. And Pascal's solution is, well, you know, fake it till you make it. Go to church, say your prayers, even though you don't feel it. And Eric Weinstein said something like this fairly recently on a podcast. He said, yeah, you can't choose to believe any particular thing all the time, but, you know, sometimes you can. So go to church, you know, and sometimes it'll click. Sometimes it'll work for you. And I actually considered that because here I live in a small town and, you know, I kind of thought about getting involved with the local Catholic Church. Also, I've been trying to learn Spanish forever, and it's just, I can tell it's not anything I'm going to do on my own. I'm going to have to be around some Spanish-speaking people, and they go to the Catholic Church. But at the same time, I've heard this expressed, you know, elsewhere, and it also occurred to me that's not really fair to that church community, you know, to that community of actual believers, for me to go in, you know, sort of like Catholic curious or theologically curious, but not really feeling it, not connected to it. It seems sort of abusive to that community or extractive or, you know, sort of mercenary. So I never did follow through with that, you know, that notion. So I will stop there and let you talk about religion.
Okay, well, yeah, that sparked a lot of thoughts. One thought is that, are you familiar with Simone Collins, Simone and Malcolm Collins? They're a little bit on the dissident right, I think, but they came into mind because I actually just bought a book of theirs off Amazon and have not started yet other than just skim a couple of chapters. But they have this book about how to create the perfect life or how to live the perfect life, that sort of thing. And so they would, you said just now that you can't exactly choose your beliefs, and they have like their book is all about how you totally can. You can intentionally choose your beliefs, and then like your life will go out from there rather than just like living your life and waiting for your beliefs to like hit you over the head. You can choose them a priori and then like go out from there. I think that's an interesting thing. I have not thought about this very much, but I do have a book about it that I'm very curious to read because it kind of like, it strikes me a little bit because I grew up religious and I do think about this all the time, that a large chunk of my life was determined by my parents' religion. Like they just chose that for me. I didn't choose that. Whereas I chose to be more of like an atheist. And just the fact that I chose it, it gave me like a power in the future of my life and where I can go from there, right? And I really like that. And I do kind of feel that I could actually choose something else at the same time. I totally could. Maybe it would feel a little griftery at first, but we can convince ourselves of anything at some level. Anyway, that's maybe a tangent, but yeah, I want to go back to the dissident right thing. I follow these people, you know, they just crop up a lot, especially on Twitter for me, also a little bit on Substack. I'm more of a leftist, I think, but I grew up so conservative. I still am completely comfortable around conservatives of all stripes. But I have noticed this divide in the world of the dissident right that I think is so fascinating. Where, are you familiar with Bronze Age Pervert?
I know the name, but I haven't read any of his stuff.
So he has a book called The Bronze Age Mindset, which I read last year, and I actually recommend people read. It's often called like, oh, like the worst book ever. Like it's so horrible and it's so fascist, et cetera, et cetera. I think people should just like read it, not fearmonger around it. So I did that actually. And it's worth reading. And I think for this one particular reason, if you are maybe into futurism or sci-fi thoughts, in that it is the exact opposite of futurism. It is the book that is, if futurism is one thing, it is the book that is the exact opposite. And for me, reading The Bronze Age Mindset, which is literally about trying to return society and our lifestyle to the time of the ancient Greeks, where the purpose and the meaning of life was to fight battles, like literal battles. And that is how you feel like fully alive and fully in the moment and fully present, rather than like living in suburbia and like taking weekly trips to Walmart, which is like so not only emasculating, but like dehumanizing. It's so like, and the way he paints this in a way that like I'm so on board with. So there's that, like returning to the ancient Greeks. That is exactly the polar opposite of what the project of futurism is, because futurism is forward looking. It's looking forward, not backwards. And I think that any thinking person will realize that there is a lot of wisdom to be had by looking backwards. But I just, like, if you are any sort of a futurist or a transhumanist, that is the worldview that you are actually legitimately fighting against at a very, like, fundamental level. So I think that people should read that as a way to, you know, like actually ground themselves in what the project of futurism is, if you are a futurist. And I think about it all the time. And maybe one more little note here that, again, I just think about like all the time, is that that guy Zoltan Istvan, who I mentioned earlier, who's this, you know, one of the most famous transhumanists out there, he very much lives like an ancient Greek. Again, like circumnavigating the globe on a boat he built himself with like 500 books in the boat, that sort of thing. And he was like the first white man to contact a number of tribes and ended up getting a job with National Geographic and like filming like tribes that no one had encountered before, but this like random dude did. He lives that lifestyle as if he were an ancient Greek, like doing the Bronze Age pervert thing, like to a T. But he's also a hardcore futurist and transhumanist who does nothing but think forward looking. So I don't know. I think that there's a tension there, but there is some way that it does kind of like make sense where you can have a lifestyle that's anti-suburbia, anti-settling down in the comforts of modernity, anti just staring at a screen nonstop all day, being fully alive and fully human, but still being a futurist and a transhumanist and still being forward looking, not backwards looking. There's a way to do that right, I think. Maybe it's different for all people, but there's a way that can be done. And to think about that, I think is really fascinating.
Are you familiar with the concept of Chesterton's fence?
Wow. That sounds familiar. J.K. Chesterton, is it?
Possibly. The notion is if you are in an unfamiliar environment and you come across a fence and you don't see any reason for the fence. I mean, there's not cattle on either side. And maybe you've got use for the building materials, or maybe, you know, you want to put a soccer field there or something. Before you tear down the fence, you should maybe do some investigation, because it's probably there for a reason. And just don't assume that the reason was never a good one, or that it's outlived its usefulness or whatever. A sort of related notion is the Lindy effect. How about that one? I know that from Nassim Nicholas Taleb. The Lindy effect is basically the longer something has been around, the longer it's likely to stay around. You know, which these are two sort of ways of getting at the idea of there are certain adaptive strategies for getting along in the world that have endured for a very long time because they work. And here mm-hmm. in the modern world, we have decided, you know what, we can rewrite all of that stuff. All of that, you know, those old patriarchal ways of doing things and nationalistic ways and ethnocentric ways of thinking, you know, that's all primitive and that's all just, it's distasteful, and we can just remake ourselves any way we want. And it seems unlikely that that's true, that a lot of a lot of the things that, you know, were not part of society 200 years ago probably won't be a couple hundred years from now. That a lot of what we think of as being very modern, very contemporary, very enlightened and up to date, you know, up to the current moment, is an experiment that is not going to prove entirely successful, and a lot of it is going to get thrown away. And so, you know, there's Bronze Age pervert saying we should live like the ancient Greeks. Terence McKenna was saying back in the 90s, hey, we need to go back to like to the Neolithic era, you know, and sort of reconnect with the consciousness of the Neolithic shamans, you know, take our mushrooms and, you know, take 5 grams and be pinned to the ground, just laid out, unable to think and talk and speak and just really connect with the numinous other. And that's, you know, that's the last sane moment we ever knew, he says. And everything that's happened since then, like the last 10,000 years, is going to be the unsuccessful experiment, except he's not anti-technology, or he's dead now, but he wasn't anti-technology. He was very excited about the prospects for, you know, transhumanism, just encapsulate a lot of different things in under a single banner. And I'm, you know, I kind of look back on Terence McKenna's rants with nostalgia, but it's, you know, it's, once you get excited with them, if you're serious about the ideas, then you need to do some work and dig in and read some other stuff that isn't quite so lyrical and, you know, easily accessible. But I think there's a lot there. I mean, I think there's a lot about humanity that it has been with us for a very long time, is innate because it has been part of our evolutionary heritage, you know, our means of coming, you know, of establishing an enduring way of surviving in the world, that will endure and that it will find a place among, you know, alongside artificial intelligence and space travel and genetic engineering and biotechnology, which I know you're excited about. So let's sort of segue to biotechnology. This is actually our second conversation. We had one with Dane Fitzgerald, which has not yet hit the web. But in it, I think I recall you basically showing a lot of excitement over the prospects for biotechnology.
Yeah, if I can actually go back just one step and have one quick follow-up comment about like what we can get rid of and what we can't. I think that it's very fascinating that some things are entirely entrenched in who we are as humans, and some things just like aren't. And the only way that we figure that out is by eliminating them and then see if society continues to progress or if it gets worse. It's all an experimentation, because I think in my view, there is no God telling us how to do these things, or it's all trial and error, by, you know, society is just society. And so like slavery, always had slavery, always did it. Every society across the globe, until all of a sudden we decided, oh, you know what? Maybe we shouldn't do this. Maybe we just like, for economic reasons, for moral reasons, for, you know, whatever. Maybe we just should try not doing this anymore, guys. And then we tried it, and lo and behold, now anyone who tries it is like a moral monster, and it's like the worst thing in the human, like possible. And we thrive having no slavery. Marriage.
Yeah, but we have machines to do that work for us now. And slavery is still practiced in lots of parts of the world. And, you know, those people don't think of themselves as being moral monsters. They think that we in the West are sort of deluded.
I'm gonna ignore that and just keep it simple here. Just to tie a little bow on my thought. everything gets complicated, KMO, but I'll keep it simple. So slavery is bad. I think I hear you on the nuance, but I'm not going to trip over the nuance. Slavery is bad. We've just like, as a globe, virtually as a globe, minus certain societies, we have actually like kind of come around to this. Marriage, on the other hand, we have tried really, really hard to get rid of marriage in the Western world. We've tried, like, the whole feminist movement effectively is trying to be anti-marriage and trying to live your life outside of that. And men, of course, have always tried to do this. And it just kind of doesn't work. Like, to this day, the happiest and the wealthiest people, they're all married, and they're all like broadcasting, ah, oh, you don't need to get married. Ah, it's a silly old religious institution. And yet they all are, like every low-key, like powerful, high human capital person, they're all married with kids. So it's like a joke, the idea that we're going to get rid of marriage as an institution. So but we only figured out that slavery we can do away with, and marriage we can't, by kind of trial and error. So like, I think that's kind of where we always are at, is like, what can we get rid of? What can we not? But anyway, I'm sorry. That was my long-winded bow on that part of the conversation. But yeah, biotech. We did have a quick conversation about this earlier. And can I tell you a little anecdote?
Sure.
So I recently, for my channel, Team Futurism, I took a trip to this guy's bio lab in San Francisco. And I just posted the video, so you can check out this little video that I did of it. But I went to this like local community bio lab, and the guy was showing me around his lab and showing me what you need to like put together your own bio lab. And I think he said, like, you know, with about $3,000, you can put together your own bio lab and you can start playing with DNA. And you can start like messing around with viruses, that sort of thing. And he did say that in general, it's not that easy to actually create a nefarious virus and or do anything like that exciting other than you can create glowing beer, that sort of thing. But in general, broad strokes, biotech is super, super, super accessible right now. And you can get basically all the tools you need to do like actual real biotech and take some classes online or whatever, and you're good to go. You can start messing with stuff. And I went to a conference, the Biohack the Planet conference. I mentioned it earlier. And there was a guy there who created his own AIDS drug, just like as a biohacker, just like doing his thing. And because he didn't have the money to or the insurance to get like the actual AIDS drug that he needed to survive. So he made it himself. I don't think that we actually realize how accessible biotech is in the biohacking phenomenon. Is very much like underground. You don't talk about it like in normal places or read about it, but there are people right now out there who are doing crazy, weird, injecting themselves with, you know, CRISPR type of things. And I do not think that we quite realize and comprehend how much this is and could potentially be changing the human species. And I was recently talking to Razib Khan. I have his interview with him on my channel. And I was asking him like, okay, so like real talk, North Korea, are they creating superhumans or what are they doing? And he's like, oh yeah, they for sure are. There's no question. They're creating superhumans. People who just like are bigger, stronger, faster. Because why the hell not? They're literally just like that. They do not have the moral qualms that we do about that sort of thing. They're just like injecting people with shit and like seeing what happens. And they're creating like weird supermen, super soldiers. And like this, I just do not think we think about this enough and the implications of it. So I think that we are living in a very strange time in terms of biotechnology, let alone all the above board stuff. Obviously, you know, AI is revolutionizing a lot of biotechnology right now, and that's crazy too. But like the underground stuff, the dudes in their garages stuff, I think is just like so fascinating. And yeah, I wish there was more of a window into that world because I'm very fascinated by it.
Yeah. So going way back, you know, what is transhumanism? If you look at the Borg on Star Trek, you know, they've got big clunky stuff bolted to their head with, you know, cables that loop way out from their bodies and lasers shooting out of them. And they, you know, they're so moribund with all this stuff that's been bolted onto them. They can't sit down, you know, and it's just like, if you look at the evolution of like the Tesla Optimus bot, it had the external, you know, loops of wires in the first generation. And then they figured out how to tighten that up, you know, pretty quickly. It seems like the Borg is very unlikely in that, you know, if they could put just a modicum, you know, of effort into public relations, a lot of people would be anxious to join the Borg. But, you know, if you're just marching around stiff-legged with a thing bolted to your face, you know, and your skin's all gray and mottled because the nanotech has no component in it that is, you know, sensitive to human comfort. Like if you just make the Borg look like subhuman monsters rather than super, super men and super women, it's, you know, you're hampering your ability to proselytize and, you know, add the biological and cultural distinctiveness of other civilizations to your own. So that always struck me as just a very sort of ham-fisted take on, you know, a collective, a cybernetic collective, basically. So imagine if instead of wires and lasers and big pieces of metal bolted into your skull, all of the things that the Borg can do that are really cool are done with biotechnology. And they're all just, you know, beautiful, athletic people with perfect skin and beautiful hair, you know, but who can coordinate their actions at a superhuman level. I mean, who wouldn't want to join that? So, you know, if you're thinking about transhumanism, you know, you might think about uploading your consciousness to a computer, or you might think about, you know, doing something with nanotechnology, but the nanotech is not made of, you know, of biological elements. It's made of, you know, rare earth elements and things like that. But the more you can implement in biotechnology, I think the more sort of appealing transhumanism becomes, to the point where it will just be sort of a silly concept. It would be like, you know, the Christian Scientist refusing, you know, what's the word I'm looking for? Antibiotics, you know, or refusing not some controversial injection, you know, like the mRNA vaccines, but like polio vaccines. Who rejects that anymore? You know, a few people, but they're weirdos. I think that the more you can do with biotech, the more the notion of transhumanism just sort of goes out the window. And that's just medicine. You know, that's just
living
in a scientific society and taking advantage.
That's another reason why I actually do think that the word transhumanism, we kind of sort of can just do without, because you're kind of right. As soon as something becomes even halfway mainstream, all of a sudden it's just medicine and it's just science. And I mean, this is actually a very... Oh man, if I'm worried or scared about anything in terms of biotech, it's that radical and very beneficial technologies could be very easily politicized right now. And so I'm disgruntled with how the mRNA vaccine became politicized, because that technology is super cool. Like, they're already rolling it out as a vaccine for cancers. And there's going to be a lot of people who are just going to die from cancer because they didn't get this vaccine, because, oh, it's an mRNA vaccine. And, oh, it's experimental. And we have Tucker Carlson saying, oh, it's an experimental. Ray Kurzweil said this thing about the mRNA vaccine that has stuck with me. He's like, you know, we're told that the mRNA vaccine for COVID, took like 3 months to develop, right? And then they rolled it out after like 3 months. It was like, no, it was 3 days. They had this thing in 3 days. Like, this is amazing, guys. Like, this should be like the coolest thing on the planet. But like, because governments were kind of like heavy-handed and like sloppy about how it was rolled out, all of a sudden, like, half the country think that it's like a scary thing. But like, that's amazing. And like, right now, again, like, it's not available yet, but like, pretty soon you're gonna get a shot, like an mRNA vaccine shot to not get certain types of cancer ever. And like, that's amazing. And we should be stoked about that and like excited to be alive in this moment, and not like, oh, the red team or the blue team rolled this out, and so I'm not gonna get it or whatever. I hate that shit so much. I think that we should just be like pro technology and not politicize things so much. There's a bunch of rabbit holes there too. I'm not sure how you feel about any of that. those are my raw thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, lots of opinions that are not really necessarily congruent with one another get bolted together in ideological factions. You know, just every side's got its catechism. And really, there's no logical connection between your views on gun control, abortion, and immigration. You know, there shouldn't be. These are very different things, and there's nothing necessarily coherent about the red tribe or the blue tribe's position on these things, but they do tend to cluster, because that's how we identify ourselves. We identify ourselves as parts of superorganisms, you know, tribal organisms. And our tribe has certain beliefs, and those beliefs didn't come about because they were logically consistent. They didn't come about because, you know, a committee of very intelligent people sat down and examined them and said, oh, this is the strongest, and this is the strongest. So let's put all these rigorously examined ideas together, and that's going to be our ideology. I mean, that's just not how it works, you know? So,
yeah,
go ahead.
It is useful to do that too, because having people in your tribe and being like a team-based person, I don't know, that's how societies thrive. So I'm not going to knock it too much, but it is annoying. And it's also kind of funny that in today's day and age, to be a heterodox person, which I kind of like float in the heterodox circles, most people who consider themselves heterodox have like the most normal views, and they're more like populist rather than heterodox. Like, if you're in a heterodox community, quote unquote, if you think that trans women shouldn't be in girls' sports. But that's like no one thinks that. Like, it's like the most mainstream normal thing to not think that trans girls should be in women. But like, just because mainstream media kind of like tamps down on that perspective, and it's been like kind of politicized or whatever, that feels heterodox, right? But it's like normies, like average normie people, both blue and red, think or have questions about biological males being in female sports, right? Like, but yeah, the whole political thing right now is kind of such a goofy mess. And I do think that we just use it to form tribes with our friends effectively.
Well, you wrote a Substack piece fairly recently about what you have labeled the dirtbag right. And you open it with a reference.
But that there's more of a case to say that this dirtbag right phenomenon could bring down society than the dirtbag left. I don't actually believe that. And I actually like spend most of my time, to be clear, criticizing the left, because I hate the left, even though I'm on it. But anyway, this is me critiquing the right a little bit.
Well, I don't think we have time to delve too deeply into the whole morass of the merger of politics and culture, or the nexus of politics and culture.
There's a lot there. Yeah,
there is a lot there. And it's, I was for a very long time part of a sort of collapse oriented community of people who were very focused on peak oil, and they thought industrial society was collapsing soon. And well, it didn't. And that scene, you know, it disintegrated, and the people went in various directions, and some of them went left and some of them went right. And the current moment doesn't really seem to allow you to resist one of those two currents. If you want to attract a large enough audience to monetize and, you know, pay the rent. So I know a guy who, you know, he was a lifelong Democrat, but he discovered that, you know, throwing red meat to the MAGA crowd brings in the Patreon bucks. And so that's his full-time gig now. And he's good at it, you know, and he says things that I suspect he doesn't really believe. But, you know, when you're getting paid to articulate a message, it's easier to just believe it. It's not that you can do it instantly. And we're going back to the, you know, the question of, can you choose what you believe? Not in a moment. Like if I were to take, you know, the two or three generations down the line from now, Neuralink connector, and just plug it into your brain and say, okay, I can see your belief system. Here's a check for $10 million. If you can genuinely believe that Kamala Harris is a shape-shifting reptilian from another direction, another dimension, in the next 5 minutes, if you can formulate that belief, not the image, not a clear thought, not the imagining, but believe it, the money is yours. I don't think you can do it.
You're so right. Wow. That's fascinating. You're absolutely right about that. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But if you write a blog about the shape-shifting reptilian overlords for 10 years, even if you started doing it for completely mercenary reasons, I think every now and again, you're going to click into a mode where you do believe it. Yes. You're just living that reality. And I think that's what Pascal was talking about with his wager.
Yeah, I think that we can talk ourselves into things. There's a concept that I've been really into lately called metamodernism. Are you familiar with this concept?
Well, I know meta and I know modernism, but put them together and I'm drawing a blank.
Yeah, let me just give a very quick overview about this. And I actually had an essay today drop about this a little bit. I've been writing about it as much as I can. So there was modernism, you know, and then that merged into, or, you know, went into postmodernism. And a lot of people are, you know, philosophers are trying to say that, like, we're kind of like at the end of at the postmodern era. It's just kind of like broken down. It became nonsensical. You can't just say there are no grand narratives. And then, like, where do you go from there? Because, like, even that itself is kind of a grand narrative. So postmodernism is inherently a little contradictory. And it just doesn't go anywhere other than it's very, you know, bleak and nihilistic at some level. And so there are some philosophers who are now starting to say that we're in the meta modern era. And this is where it's marked by an oscillation between postmodern irony and modern sincerity. And so if you look at a lot of movies or or books, for example, you can find books where characters are like self-aware of their scenario in life. But they're also like, they swing back to being sincere at the same time. And this is where we are right now with a lot of these things, where you can be moment by moment ironic or sincere, and you can oscillate back and forth between the two. You can be traditionally religious on Sunday and then on Monday be a hardcore capitalist and realize that tension there and be fine with that, because that this is the modern day. We are like in the meta-modern era where we're oscillating back and forth between these two things, and just like in the merger of them, maybe it's making something new and something different, and this is like maybe the way forward for ourselves and our culture, is to just like just humor this oscillation. And I think that that's maybe also a nice summary of where I was getting at earlier in the conversation, with this tension between the Bronze Age perverts and the Zoltan Isfans, the looking backwards and the looking forwards. I think that you can like oscillate between the two a little bit, and maybe that is the most modern thing that you can do.
Very good. Well, let's leave it there. I think we're both reaching the end of our vocal stamina. Usually I have got a lot more, but you know, some days the throat just doesn't cooperate. All right. Well, Peter, what projects do you want to bring to people's awareness?
Yeah, check out my Substack. It's the Decadence Project. And also I have a podcast called Team Futurism that's on YouTube or wherever you find podcasts. And also, yeah, check out my book, The Singularity Survival Guide. I think that it's, especially if you're into goofy literature, that you'll appreciate it.
And I think it's worth saying that it's 99 cents on Kindle, so not going to break the bank.
There you go.
All right. Well, thanks so much.
Yep, thanks so much.
All right, that was Peter Clark. He has got a Substack. I've read some of his Substack work. He also has a podcast. I have not yet listened to his podcast work, but links to all that good stuff and to his book are in the show notes for this episode, which you can find at, I think the easiest way to direct you to it is on Substack, kmoptimal.substack.com. All right, I will talk to you again soon. Stay well.